This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, from the arts to sports, and from business to history, and everything in between, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. That's OurAmericanStories.com. There's on the navigation bar the words Your Story. Click that and just fill out the form. We make it really easy for you. Talking about that, up next is a story from our regular contributor and listener on WHO in Des Moines, Joy Neal Kidney. Joy is the keeper of her family's history and the author of Liara's Letters, the story of love and loss for an Iowa family during World War II. Today, Joy shares with us a short story on the importance of an ordinary tree in her own yard. Take it away, Joy.
There's a humble maple tree in the backyard that has worked its way into our hearts. You probably wouldn't call this most ordinary maple beautiful any season of the year. Other maple trees have handsome leaves and are colorful in autumn. This unremarkable tree has nondescript leaves in autumn that just turn a dull yellow, the bland color of cornflakes. Not long after we moved back to Iowa with a toddler, we discovered that this plain neighbor casts a fine, dense shadow. Soon, our two-year-old was digging in a sandbox beside the trunk, screened from the sun and heat by a leafy green canopy. We found that as the sultry summer sun lowered in the afternoon sky, the maple's blessed shade sheltered our small patio and west windows. The branches of the maple were a little too high for even a bigger kid to climb, but my husband roped a tire swing to one stout limb. When our son gained some years and inches, his dad added a knotted climbing rope. During summer's thunderstorms, we marvel at the maple's flexibility and tenacity. The wind whips and churns, flinging writhing branches in a wild dance. We try to imagine the huge network of underground roots anchor it during violent storms. Remembering words like photosynthesis and xylem and phloem from biology, I ponder at our ordinary tree, piping up water and minerals from its roots, mixing them with carbon dioxide absorbed through its leaves from the air, making food for the tree, and donating precious oxygen to us. We do nothing for this faithful servant except to carry away the winged seeds it sends whirligigging down in the spring. And come autumn, my husband rakes up its crisp, curled, drab leaves. The tree's skeleton in winter is often defined by a skiff of snow. The light from a full moon glows through its branches, casting a bony shadow against the ground. The now towering tree provides a safe place for fox squirrels to winter, curled up in their penthouse nests, where babies are born in the spring. A few weeks later, the newly leafed maple is a haven for migratory birds. Several springs I've been serenaded by a rose-breasted grosbeak perched in the tree while planting morning glories. It is housed its share of nestlings, usually robins. The uncelebrated tree was decimated several years ago during a March ice storm. heaps of budded branches, large and small, crashed and tinkled, spilling ice on the frozen lawn. Remaining branches jutted awkwardly, looking as if a huge monster had twisted and dismembered the tree. My husband did some first aid on it and called a tree trimmer, but the maple mainly needed to heal to exert its own resilience. In spite of our worrying, it has done just fine and has returned to its main job, being our chief shade tree. The sandbox is gone. So are the climbing rope and tire swing. In fact, our son has a little girl of his own. But today, cloistered in the shade of the maple, I enjoy a mug of coffee and contemplate the blessings of one ordinary tree.
And great job, Monty, and a special thanks to Joy Neal Kidney. And I think we all have that tree in our lives. I mean, we had really, in my family, where I grew up, one big chestnut tree that was special to us. And the sound of those chestnuts dropping on the roof always got me going. And then collecting them up and ultimately being able to use them for good around Halloween and around Thanksgiving was even better. And in my own home now, a great white oak, which we light up because it's so beautiful, and the dogwoods all around our house, which, my goodness, when they bloom, there's nothing quite like it. A beautiful story about an ordinary tree by a listener at WHO and a regular contributor now, Joy Neal Kidney's story about her ordinary tree here on Our American Story. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com. And we continue here on Our American Stories. And up next, we bring you Ben Craddock. He brings us the story of the gas station business his father, Ron Craddock, started right here in Mississippi. Ron started from pretty close to nothing, and he worked his way up from there. Here's Ben to tell his family's story.
My dad, Ron Craddock, he came from nothing. One brother and two sisters, and they had a one-bedroom home. And so he slept on the floor his whole life. Always wanted more from himself, and so he always had a drive in him to be better, not let his circumstances define him. He went through college, got his degree, went to Vietnam, did that for 4 years, came back and was trying to find a job. And so he met my mother, they got married, and my grandfather had a gas station, a Phillips 66, I believe. And so he told my dad, hey, you know, why don't you try to get into the fuel business, and you know, it's a good way to, you know, to make a life. So my dad got on with ExxonMobil. He started off as a store manager, worked his way up to district manager, and then he was over the Southeastern Territory. My brother, David, who's 7 years older, was born in Birmingham because we moved around a lot. So once I were born in Memphis, my dad and Mr. Taft Little, they had the Southeastern Territory for ExxonMobil. And so they oversaw all the distributors, which, you know, run their independent distributors. So they were their go-to people. There was two plants that were for sale in Mississippi at the time. This was actually 41 years ago. So it's kind of a cool story, actually. My dad, I love it when he tells me. So they're driving down to Macomb, Mississippi, and they were discussing the plant that was for sale. There was like two stores and a bulk plant. And then in Tupelo, Mississippi, there was, I think, four stores and a bulk plant. And so back then, that was a lot, you know, because you could make some money off fuel. It was, you know, I think you could make 30 cents off a gallon. Now it's like negative 10, you know. So as they're driving to Macomb, they both wanted that was the best deal, was the Macomb distributorship. So that said, they kept arguing over who gets this, who gets that. So my dad's like, let's just flip a coin. You know, if it lands on heads, I get Macomb. If it lands on tails, you know, whatever. So they flipped a coin, it landed on heads, and so Dad got Macomb. So he couldn't find anyone to back him as far as a bank. Because, you know, my dad didn't have any, they didn't have anything. Went to every bank in the state of Mississippi, and Trustmark was the only bank that would give my dad a chance. He grew it to about 6, 7, 8 stores when I was in high school. Once I got through with college at Ole Miss in 2000, the year 2000, he had 11 stores. He had some restaurants. My dad was one of the first to, you know, now it's common when you see a Subway, a Crystal, or some type of food inside a gas station. Well, my dad did that 30 years ago. He had a Dairy Queen inside of a gas station, and people thought it was disgusting. They were like, you don't eat where you get your fuel. And it was years ago, and it didn't work because it was way ahead of its time. But they did an article on my dad a while back, and I forgot, a convenience store news magazine, and that's what they discussed. My dad's always been about 5 years ahead of things. He can just see things. He has a feel for the business. And I think that goes back to he had to scrap for everything. You know, he had to teach himself accounting because he didn't trust an accountant. So he still does our taxes at 78 years old. But, you know, saying all that, when we decided, my dad told me and my brother, you know, I remember sitting in the Piccadilly in Macomb, Mississippi, 19 years ago, and my dad wanted to meet with my brother and I, and he basically told us, you know, things are changing. You got Kroger, Walmart. You have these big guys coming in. They're selling fuel now. So for us to make it, we either have to triple in size to have a chance, which means you owe a lot of debt, but it can pay off, or we can sell out and y'all can go do your own thing. So brother and I looked at each other and said, we want to take it and grow it. And so we took 11 stores, and as I sit here today, we're at, I want to say, 68 stores, and we run around 20 different restaurants, different type restaurants. You know, we took an opportunity. We've worked our tails off. It's been neat with my dad. He's the group that he came in with, there was probably 5 or 6 guys that he had close relationships with because they were distributors when he was just the district supervisor with ExxonMobil. And so, you know, everybody, my dad and his friends, they're getting older. So they decided, yeah, you know, we're ready to sell out, but we're going to ask Ron first because his boys have taken over and see if they want to buy us out. So I'll never forget the first company is Hightower Oil out of Grenada, Mississippi, Mr. George Hightower. He had 8 stores. And so that was our first opportunity, and it was September the 11th, 2001. So I'll never forget that day, 9/11. We were getting into my dad's car when the planes hit the towers. And as we drove to Grenada to meet with Mr. George, that's all we discussed about. We were in shock, but it's one thing I'll never forget is that feeling, but I'll never forget. I can't remember the other companies that we bought during that time because, you know, it's been kind of here and there throughout the years, but I'll never forget that day. And that day actually changed our company also because, you know, we doubled in size. So we've had opportunities because of my dad's relationships with friends to buy their companies because their kids did not want to, you know, want anything to do with it. And then we actually recently bought Mr. Little out, which was my dad's partner when they were district managers with Exxon. And we bought Tupelo probably, I want to say, 4 years ago. So, and that was around 21 stores. You know, we've been blessed. We had an opportunity from my dad with his work, his hard work, and we truly try to capitalize. We work our tails off, you know, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we just go until it's done. That's kind of how we were raised. My mother is the glue to our family. She is a true, I would say everybody says, she's always put together. You know, true Southern Belle. She's never smoked. She's never drank. I've only heard her cuss twice, and that was at me. She is the most godly woman I've ever been around, ever met. She truly, truly is, just very special. So she really, without my mom and her guidance, and without the opportunities that God put in front of us, you know, we would not have the opportunities we have now. I graduated in December of 2000, got married in February, right after we both graduated. We moved to Jackson, Mississippi, because my wife was going to dental school. So I knew we would be in Jackson for 4 years. I didn't really know what would happen after that. So I don't know if anybody listening has worked for family. Sometimes working for your family can be good. Sometimes it can be destructive. My dad is he doesn't play around. He ran things with an iron fist. He was always fair. They respect him, but they fear him in a good way. He's all business. And it took me a while to adjust to my dad, but his plan really was awesome.
And we're listening to Ben Craddock tell the story of his parents. And my goodness, what an influence his father had, and his upbringing too. He slept on a floor throughout much of his young life. We get up at 4 in the morning, and we go until we get it done. When we return, more of the Craddock family story as told by Ben about his parents here on Our American Story. And we're back with Our American Stories and the story of the Craddock family, who operate or service over 70 gas stations and 16 fast service restaurants in the state of Mississippi, where we broadcast from. But Ron Craddock worked his way up from nearly nothing, and he made his sons, Ben and David, do the same. Here's Ben to tell us more.
I graduated in December of 2000, got married in February, right after we both graduated. We moved to Jackson, Mississippi, because my wife was going to dental school. So I knew we would be in Jackson for 4 years. I didn't really know what would happen after that. So I don't know if anybody listening has worked for family. Sometimes working for your family can be good. Sometimes it can be destructive. My dad he doesn't play around. He ran things with an iron fist. He was always fair. They respect him, but they fear him in a good way. He's all business. And it took me a while to adjust to my dad, but his plan really was awesome because when I look back on it, we have two separate companies. We have Craddock Oil Company, and we have a company called What a Combo, Inc. Well, the What a Combo Company, it runs all our food brands. It has nothing to do with Craddock Oil Company. So he set those up just in case my brother and I wanted to come back. because he knew that he raised two kids to be CEOs, not VPs. And he raised two leaders, not two followers. So the first 2 years of my working career, I worked for a guy named Lewis McGee. And Mr. Lewis ran What A Combo. And they were awesome. You know, I started off an employee, a manager, supervisor, and then about year two, I was supervising all our Subways. And then my dad said, all right, time for a change. I want him to work for David, which is my brother. So I went to Craddock Oil to work over there. So I started off as an employee, worked myself up to a manager. Then Katrina hit as I was managing. Well, I was managing a store in Jackson that we just bought, which was really an eye-opener. My brother put me over all our Jackson stores, which were, we had eight stores. And, you know, I went from employee to a manager to a supervisor. So as you can see in both patterns, I started from the bottom as I worked my way to the top, right? And so I learned how it felt to be an employee standing on your feet for 8-10 hours a day. I understood what it was to be a manager accountable for those employees. I learned what it was to be a supervisor that's in charge of every manager plus the employees. I'm blessed to say that having worked for my dad, Mr. Lewis McGee, my brother, so much went into it over about a 10-year span. And about 12 years ago, I got called into a meeting with my brother and my dad. And my dad said, all right, What A Combo's yours. And I said, okay. You know, and I said, you sure? He's like, yeah. I mean, you got it. It's yours. Run it. And my brother is a lot like my dad. My brother said, look, you've earned it. You've basically helped me clean. You know, we were a lot smaller back then. So when things were broken, we would have to fix it. We didn't have the money to hire all these different companies to fix things for us. And there were things in Jackson that I saw, I don't even want to repeat on air because they were disgusting, but we had to clean things up that no human should ever see. But our people respected us because my brother and I would be in a restroom with gloves on, cleaning things off a wall. We were going, how did somebody write their name with that? You know what I mean? Like some people are just nasty. So, but the respect you get because that manager would sit and tell 10 managers. So, you know, you don't get respect. You got to earn respect. That's how we did it. That's how my dad, if I go back to the original, at the beginning, my dad came from nothing and he worked his way to the top. That's the only way he knows how to get it done. You can't tell anybody how to lay a grill if you never laid a grill before at Crystal. It doesn't work. So I was luckily brought along. I learned from some really good men, not besides my dad and my brother, that really cared enough about me to share more than just business, but life experiences. And so it truly, I was blessed. And so when I had my opportunity, my first day I took over to run What A Combo was the first day we opened our Crystal in Byram. And you talking about, you know, getting handed a can of whoops. You know, we did, I think, our first day, we did like $9,000 in sales. And usually a Crystal does between $2,000 to $4,000 a day. But it taught me so much about being prepared and what we need to do the next day, just from my past experiences. You know, since then, you know, we've opened Oxford, Crystal, Satillo. We've redone other. But the one thing I've learned through all my experiences through working for my dad and these other men and women is compassion. Because if you treat an employee like crap, they're not going to work hard for you. But if you treat an employee like they matter, which they do to me, then they'll do anything for you. So I teamed up with the Kellum brothers, you know, my friend Chris. And so I took his plan and he helped me develop this thing and put it into practice. And it is basically, you know, I'm living my story through my company. And what that means is we're here to serve. We're here to serve God first. We're here to serve others. We're here to provide for people that don't have means to eat or have the money to buy meals or the money to buy fuel, like things that we might take for granted. We figure out ways to get to those people. And so that has been my focus in the last couple of years, is to get everybody that's, you know, on my team to believe in it, first of all, buy into what we're doing. Because if you don't have the same compassion that we all have, and luckily my group does, you know, I hire people that are like me with the heart. I hire smarter people, but one thing we do is it's fun watching somebody get the confidence to go out there and serve, or get the confidence to go out there and do things on their own without me having to tell them, because they're living out their purpose and their why on this earth, and they're doing it while they're working their job. You know, recognizing them, it's been really fun. It's just I've tried to create a working environment, just like my dad, a fun working environment, but one that represents my beliefs and my morals.
And you're listening to Ben Craddock write a love letter, in essence, to his parents, and especially to his dad, who had taught him basically how to put in a day's work and how to respect work and respect every facet of a business by doing it. You can't give advice on laying out a grill at a crystal if you haven't laid out a grill. I'm living my story through my company, and so many people do that in this country. They live out their story through their businesses and through their work. I'm here to serve God first and serve our customers next. For so many Americans, their faith animates everything they do, and most particularly and most certainly it does to the Craddock family. The story of Ron Craddock, told by Ben Craddock, here on Our American Story. And we continue with Our American Stories, and with the story of an immigrant named Audrey Gruce. And this is the kind of story that can only happen in America. Here's Audrey.
My parents would never have left Lithuania. My mother was a school teacher, and my father was a dashing and quite handsome cavalry officer. And the two of them met and had me, and unfortunately, when I was an infant, Lithuania was nearing the end of the war, World War II, and my parents fled Lithuania because my dad would have been forced by the communists to work with them. He had actually escaped working with the Germans when they first came up north. He somehow escaped from a German prison camp because he would not work with them. And then when the communists came down, they, of course, took over Lithuania. And then Lithuania became a republic of the Soviet Union when it was a little bit sold down the river at the Yalta Conference. Roosevelt simply gave Lithuania and the Baltic countries to the communists, and that was a terrible thing, a terrible period for the country. What my parents used to say is the communists could take anything and everything away from us, but they can't take away your education and your spirit. My parents fled. They fled by going south. They went into Poland and Germany. They ended up in a displaced persons camp, and my father became commandant of that camp run by the Americans. And they were very lucky that they had relatives who lived in the United States, in Newark, New Jersey, that were able to sponsor them. It was an amazing story for my parents and very difficult. And I think that the trauma of the war, of coming to America, just the tragedy and trauma of it ultimately, I think, affected my mother, who was very creative and very sensitive. She was a poet. She wrote poetry every day of her life. And my mother loved to express herself through iambic pentameter. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I would memorize her poems as a child and recite them on Radio Free Europe, because their dream was to go back to their country, where they lived in a beautiful suburb. And I think that every refugee from any country that they love and have a history with has to go through some kind of emotional trauma. And ultimately, it caught up with my mother. My mother had what they called a nervous breakdown in, I think it was the late 50s, early 60s. She simply gave up. We found her, my father found her, kind of catatonic, just not moving in a corner of our home. We didn't know very much. The children, by then, two sisters and I, kind of weren't aware of all that happened. But my father said that my mother is sick. She was taken to the hospital. And in those days, nervous breakdown was all they told my father. There wasn't much communication with the doctors. And a nervous breakdown, today we know, is major depression. And they really did not know that much about it in those days. So we had a very loving, up, creative, fun, wonderful mother that we knew. And when she came home, we knew that somehow her nerves were broken. My sisters and I thought that we did it. We felt very guilty and very scared. You know, children often take responsibility, thinking that they're involved in everything, in every way. And it was really a very difficult time for both my father and my sisters and I, because we witnessed years of different diagnoses, years of different medications, and kind of this terrible sadness that is, and loss of energy that is a mark of depression. It was at times embarrassing. Mental health was not spoken about. Depression was not a word that people used. In writing, they used melancholia and talked about Orson Welles or referred to in other literate ways. All those years of my family being aware of my mother struggling with depression, we were unable, unless to the most private of friends, we were unable to share our story. It was terrible at times. You know, some young friends would make fun. They'd say, your mother's crazy, or terrible things. And that's how people viewed it sometimes. And I remember it was the days of when people had cancer. You crossed the street when someone had the big C because you thought it was contagious. All based on ignorance. So I realized only after my mother's death, 16 years ago, I realized that I might be able to do something in this field. I was devastated when my mother died. And I talked to her psychiatrist. He, in turn, introduced me to neuroscientists and other people in the mental health field. And I remember someone suggesting that we just open a center, a neuroscience center. Well, I just didn't feel that bricks and mortar, and big bricks and mortar, was the answer. I really felt we had to get to the bottom of what's going on in depression and in mental health. And some of the neuroscientists told me that there was a crisis going on in the field of research. 7 or 8 of the leading pharmaceutical companies were getting out of the brain biology research fields because it was simply too expensive and they weren't getting new medications fast enough. It was written up in the New York Times that Big Pharma is out of brain and bio research. And at that time, most of the basic antidepressants out there were versions of Prozac. Prozac was introduced in 1985. So that was, in all that time, we had no new categories of medication. 35% of the people who have depression struggle with it and don't have an antidepressant that works for them, where they have terrible side effects. So it's amazing that in 35 years since Prozac was introduced, no new category. All of these facts came into play, and I thought, why don't I try? Why don't I try to create a foundation for advanced research named after my mother, Hope? What better name could there be than the ironic coincidence that my mother's name was Hope? So I started a foundation, the Hope for Depression Research Foundation, named after my mother, Hope, what is now the most advanced and number one depression research organization in the country. We are now in two clinical trials with a major new category of medication. My story is really an only in America story. It could not have happened in other parts of the world because we as Americans are known for our philanthropy. In other parts of the world, in socialized countries in Europe, they are accustomed to the government taking care of them, accustomed to the government funding scientific research, funding culture, funding all kind of these government securities that are given to people. And people don't feel that they should privately be donating to anything cultural. They have been taught that the government will take care of it. In America, we know that that is not the way that it happens, and that private people can make an enormous difference with their own inspiration, their own aspiration, and their own achievements. I really feel that my story and what I was able to create could never have happened anywhere but good old USA.
And great job, as always, to Joey for producing the piece. And thanks to Audrey Gruss for sharing her story, her mom's story, and her rebuttal to what happened to her mom. A beautiful rebuttal. And Audrey is the founder of the Hope for Depression Research Foundation. You can learn more about their work and support it at hopefordepression.org. Audrey Gruss's story, a great American dreamer story, here on Our American Stories.